We've been doing this series for a few weeks now called What's Up with Christians, and we've been talking about objections that people typically have to Christianity. And tonight what we're going to be talking about is the idea that Christians reject what we call macroevolution. Now, microevolution refers to adaptation and within species, but macroevolution refers to the so-called theory that the world has developed through this slow process of mutations and genetic alterations leading to the vast number of species that we have on Earth today.
From goo to you by way of the zoo.
Do you guys catch that? From goo to you by way of the zoo. I like that. And so Jim is going to be sharing three common arguments brought against evolution. So these are arguments by people who are theists, people who believe in God and his role in creation. We'll be talking about these three main arguments today. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just give Jim a couple of minutes up here to just kind of talk a little bit, and then we're going to kind of get into our three main arguments. And the way it's going to work is I'm going to sort of interview Jim, and we're going to talk for a couple of minutes about each argument. And then at the end of that time, these microphones here, the wireless ones, are going to be available up front for you to come up and ask Jim questions, things that he might have brought up, things that you're fuzzy on, or other questions that you want to ask him. We do ask that you keep them either Bible or science related. As much fun as it would be to come up and ask a question like, where do babies come from? Not really our main topic. You missed that last week. So I'm going to give Jim the mic for a couple minutes, and then I'll come back up, and we're going to start the interview process with Jim.
I have four kids. I probably get help with those questions. Okay. All right. Well, let me just start, because there's something I wanted to mention anyhow before we get the projector going, and that does it seem crazy to you? Because now you, especially you who are in public school, are going to be taught evolution as being fact. It's the way it is, and you're going to get that hours a day, 5 days a week, and then you're going to come here on Wednesdays and get a 45-minute talk. And does it make any sense? I mean, why would they not be teaching creation in school if creation is true? And I believe creation is true. Why wouldn't they be teaching it in school? Anybody have any suggestions? Why would that be? Yeah, they do think that humans come from monkeys. That's the progression that they're saying. But why wouldn't they? Why if I'm correct, why aren't they teaching this in school? Why do you go to school and learn something that's just opposite of what I'm teaching or what I'm explaining? Well, let me just jump in and tell you what I think it is, and that is, creation requires a miracle. It requires an act of God. And in our country, we've got it set up right now where you're not allowed to have acts of God in school. It wasn't always that way. It wasn't that way back when the country was set up. But now, prayer has been left out, and God has been pretty much left out. And so there's something called naturalism. Did we talk about that last time? I don't think we did. Naturalism.
No,
I am a supernaturalist, and I think most of you are too. Supernaturalist means that you believe that there is a natural world, but there's also a supernatural world. Where God resides, and that miracles can occur, but creation is a supernatural event. It's something that requires an act of God. And since you're not allowed to talk about God in school, you're not allowed to talk about creation in school. But it's true. And what I want to show you today is some evidences that creation actually did occur, and that evolution couldn't possibly have occurred. So okay.
Great. So our first argument is called the fine-tuning argument. The basic thing that this argument states is that the world is tuned in such a way that it's been created, or it has been it exists with such complexity that it's impossible for the world to exist in any other way. And so the idea that there has been this slow evolving process by which the world has come about seems to not make sense, given how much complexity is required for the world to exist the way it currently does. So I'm going to hand things over to
okay.
Jim.
Yeah, I accepted Christ when I was in about 1978, before you guys were born. But anyhow, in about 1981, there was an article in Scientific American called The Many Worlds Theory. And what they were doing was they were describing the fact that our universe is very finely tuned. Gravity has to be just exactly what it is. It can't be any stronger or any weaker. If it was too strong, you know, people like us couldn't grow because we'd be crushed into the ground. If it was too weak, we'd float off into space. And they found that this is true of all the different the four fundamental constants. They have to be just particular values. There's no way to know what they are except to measure them. You know, there's no reason why they are but what they are. But if there were anything else, we wouldn't have life as we know it. And so they were writing an article in Scientific American, and they were putting forth the idea that there's many worlds. There's an infinite number of worlds, universes out there. We live in one universe, and the universe we have has these particular constants such that life can exist. But there's an infinite number of them. Well, that's a supernatural argument. That's no different than saying that God made it. It's just as easy to say that God made it as to say something like that. But this was an incredible thing that they found out. Now my computer closed on me. For I just got to get back in here. Just give me a second here. Let's see.
So while Jim's doing that, just to summarize what he's said so far, if the world is created in such a fine-tuned way, the way that is commonly the way that an atheist or a non-theistic person would address that was to say, well, there exists an infinite number of universes, and our particular universe, things are aligned the way that they are. So if you're familiar with pretty much any comic book series of anything these days, you've heard talk about this concept of there being the existence of multiple Earths. And so this is nothing more than an idea. It doesn't even qualify as a theory or even a hypothesis.
And yet it was in Scientific American.
Right. And so the basically what we're saying is that to believe in the idea that there's multiple universes and that this explains how ours exists takes as much faith as believing that there's some being powerful enough to create it.
There's no evidence of it. There can't be any evidence. There are other universes. But the thing is, it allows them to have a creator with no obligations. It takes away the moral requirements that God puts on us. So that's the only reason why they do it. So here's a list of, this is real small, and I'm going to make a big one after this. But this is about a half a dozen, or a dozen and a half rather, parameters that have to be exactly what they are in order for our universe to be what it is. And the first four I blocked off, and I'll make them a little bigger so you can see what they are. The first one is gravity. You know that. That's what keeps us on the ground. Weak nuclear force, that's what keeps the atoms together. And then electromagnetic force, that's what is running my computer and things like that, and what runs magnets. And strong nuclear force is what keeps the nucleus together. That's what you break when you make a hydrogen bomb and it release huge amounts of energy. Here's the relative strengths of these. If the gravitational force was considered to have a force of 1, the weak nuclear force has a force of 10 to the 29th. Any idea how big that is? That's a 1 with 29 zeros after it, okay? And the electromagnetic is 10 to the 36th, and the strong nuclear force is 10 to the 38th. 10 to the 38th is 100 billion, 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 billion. And, you know, it's just inconceivable. Now, these numbers have to be just what they are, or what we have wouldn't work. So here, let me show you a quick video on this to get an idea about this.
During the past 40 years, scientists have determined the relative strengths of each of these primary laws and forces. These strengths are so critically balanced, they are often described as being finely tuned.
If you're to take the basic fundamental constants of nature and you were to change these even slightly, or you were to pick their values at random, you would almost never get a universe that would be habitable in any sort of way. That is, you couldn't have galaxies, you couldn't have planets, you couldn't have complex biological organisms if these fundamental constants were even slightly different, slightly stronger, slightly weaker than they actually are in this universe. That's the idea of fine-tuning.
To better appreciate this concept, imagine a machine able to control the strengths of each of the physical constants. If you changed even slightly from its current setting, the strength of any one of these fundamental forces, such as gravity, the impact on complex life would be catastrophic.
If you increased it by a little bit, no large-scale life forms could exist. Anything that was more than the size of a pea would be completely crushed. So you might be able to get life of a very, very primitive sort, such as bacteria, but you could never get conscious observers.
Okay. So you follow that? That's a very strong argument, and it just has been just recently that this has been found. For centuries, we thought that our universe just the numbers wouldn't matter what they were. We could produce life, but now we're finding that's not the case. So that's probably enough for this.
Yeah, I think so. Why don't we take a couple minutes if you guys have any questions, either about this argument, use the microphones here. Use the microphones.
How come we can go to the moon?
How come we can go to the moon? You mean with the gravity that we have? Well, you mean the gravity on the moon? Well, the gravity on the moon is about a sixth of what it is here on Earth. But it is interesting that we have just, that's another thing that people have found, is that we are specially situated so that we can observe our universe. We can see out into, we can see the moon. We've been able to go to the moon. We can see out into other galaxies. If we were other places in our galaxy, we'd just be a mass of stars and we couldn't see out to other galaxies. We can see so far off that we can see what's considered to be around 10 billion light years out. In other words, that's how far light travels in 10 billion years. That's how far out we can see. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but...
Well, there's no natural life on the moon at the current moment, right? So the moon does have a different gravitational pull than Earth, but nothing lives there. And even when we go out there, we have to wear these high-tech, you know, like super suits so that we don't die.
Right.
I don't.
Okay. Any other questions?
Can you come up to the mic so that everyone can hear your question?
We change our gravity?
How can we change it? We can't. It's a fundamental constant of the universe. The only thing we can do is make the Earth smaller. If you make the Earth smaller, gravity would get lighter.
Then why is there a theory?
Oh, the theory is an explanation. You can go out and measure gravity. You can't change it. It is what it is. But when the theory tries to explain why it is what it is, that's what we call a theory.
Right.
Okay?
Right. Thanks. Any other questions before we go on?
Run to the phone, to the mic.
Just come up to the mic so that everybody can hear you so we don't have to tell you to yell.
Some things I picked up in my science book as I'm reading it is gravity is actually a relative term for mass and volume. So this is more of a comment than a question. But volume is how much... Mass is how much force the gravity pushes down on an object. So the heavier the object, the more gravitational pull the Earth has on it. That's why rocks are so heavy, because they have more mass.
Right.
Mass is how much matter is packed into an object. So that's why you can have a tiny object that's as heavy as a large rock.
Right.
So the reason why we... don't get pushed into the ground because of gravitational pull is because we have an equal amount of force pushing out from our bodies to
our feet.
Yes, to level the pressure out.
Yeah, I made that law. Say what? I just made that law. Yes.
A different Isaac, but yes. Okay.
We're
good. We got 5 minutes.
You said that like the gravity of Earth was 1, and then there was the 10 to the 26 and stuff. What is that unit of measurement, and how do we know the gravitational pull of the sun? Was there, like, math with ellipses in it or something? Like, how did we mathematically figure that out for scientifically, or how did we measure that?
Well,
the units on gravity are measured in what it is. This gets kind of complicated, so we probably don't want to do too much, but the force is equal to G, that constant that we're talking about, times F1 times F2 divided by the distance squared. And so when you work out all the units, I could tell you what it is afterwards, but it's... I mean M1, M2, the mass of the first object, like you, and the mass of the Earth. You multiply those two together, then you take the distance between them, and that gives you the force.
How did we get the sun and the Earth gravitational pull towards each other?
The same thing. You take the mass of the Earth, and you take the mass of the sun, and then you take the distance between them, and between those two, you know, putting that into the equation gives you the force that's holding the Earth in its orbit.
But which gravity measurement do you use?
You have to, they're the same. The sun is being pulled to the earth, and the earth is being pulled to the sun. Right now, the earth is being pulled toward you. You're sucking up the earth right now. That's right. You're right. It's happening both. You're being drawn to the earth, and the earth's being drawn to you. Same time. Can we what? Pull up to the sun? Wait, hang on.
Let's give Zach a go.
You said there were an infinite amount of universes, so have we found other Earths identical to ours? And if we have, is there life on that planet like ours?
Okay, first of all, to clarify, I don't believe there are an infinite number of universes. There's no infinity in any part, in any place in our universe. And to make up, they made up an infinite number of universes in order to explain this. But I don't believe that. I believe there's one universe created by God, and in that universe, there's a lot of planets. That might be what you're talking about. There's 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and there's 100 billion galaxies in the universe. That's 10,000 billion stars in the universe. And so it's a big universe. Read Psalm 8, and you'll get an idea how big our universe is. And it was even amazing to David when he wrote the Psalms.
Do you have another one for us?
Well, heaven is not a physical place. Heaven is not; it doesn't have mass. And heaven is that's what we're talking about being extranatural, supernatural. Nature is the only place where we know about mass and time and things like that. Heaven exists even outside of our time, in fact. And Albert Einstein told us that. Yeah.
So you mentioned strong nuclear energy, which is what bonds the nucleus together.
Right.
And you said that basically breaking that apart causes a lot of energy.
It lets off a lot of energy.
Nuclear weapons.
So right.
Why would that expend a lot of energy, especially if it's in an object so small?
Well, because there's so much energy bound up. See, the protons want to go apart, right? Because it's a positive charge and a positive charge. They want to push apart. That strong nuclear force inside keeps them held together. Like if I were to come over and give you a rubber band, and you grab the rubber band, and I pull and 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 pull, I'm storing up energy in there, and then I let it go. What happens? You get hit. Hurts, right? So that's what the more energy that's tied up in there, the more energy gets released when you let it go, and that's what happens in a nuclear weapon. It's an atom smasher. It smashes the atoms, and then they give off this tremendous amount of energy. That answer the question?
All right, we're going to come back for more questions in a couple of minutes. For now, Jim is going to talk about our second discussion point, which speaks specifically of the dating of the events of Earth, the dating of fossils and other things like that. And so Jim is going to talk a little bit about the idea of how we date, and I don't mean like romantically, but how we determine how old the Earth is.
Okay, all right. There's a lot of different aspects to this, and I'm only going to talk about one, but I'm just going to go down to give you an idea of them. The geological evidence, you've got erosion. If you go and you look, for instance, go on Google Maps and look at the Mississippi Delta, the amount of dirt that's gone into the ocean, into the Gulf of Mexico from the Mississippi Delta, the scientists have calculated it would take several thousand years for that to accumulate. Several thousand years? What's the deal here? It's supposed to have been around for millions of years. How come there's only several thousand years worth of dirt in the Mississippi Delta? There's all kinds of things like that that point to a young Earth. Our erosion. If we had erosion going on for a billion years, all the ground above sea level should have washed down into the sea by now. It's the sun bakes the ground, actually breaks down the rocks. The ultraviolet light in the sun breaks down the rocks, little amounts of it. When the rain comes, it runs it down into the rivers, and so your rivers are filled with minerals and things, and over time, that all gets washed down. In a billion years, you would have the entire, all the earth that's above sea level would have been washed into the sea by now. So all kinds of things like that. Now that's not what I was going to talk about tonight. Radioactive carbon in diamonds. Diamonds have radioactive carbon in them, and radioactive carbon has a half-life, which I don't know if I can explain that to you right now, but has a half-life of about 5,700 years. So these diamonds are supposed to be millions of years old. In a million years, if you had the entire diamond, entire Earth made out of carbon-14, it would have broken down by now. So that's another thing that shows that these diamonds are young. Okay.
And Jim, I know you're going to get to this, but I know one of the questions that we often have in school, and especially as we look at different textbooks and things, it seems the biggest argument against the Earth being young is fossils, which is what you're about to get to. And specifically, it seems like the history of particularly dinosaurs is just so fundamentally accepted as true. What evidence do we have that the explanation of how old dinosaurs are might not be as accurate as we think?
Okay, that's going to be my last point. And let me give you something before that, just before I give you that point. And that is, you're going to see in this video that I'm going to show you, these people are just amazed. They're just amazed. Now, if you were an archaeologist and you opened up a pyramid, and inside you found a tray with a McDonald's wrapper right next to it and a hot hamburger and a steaming hot thing of fries, what would be the thing you would think? Would you think, how in the world did this steaming pile of fries last for 2,000 years in a pyramid? No, you wouldn't say that. You'd say somebody's been here already and brought in a McDonald's hamburger and an order of fries, right? Well, watch this video, because this is what happens when they find dinosaur bones that have flesh inside of it, not fossilized. It's still stretchy, you know, like your tendons or your skin. They find flesh still existing inside the bones of these dinosaurs. This video, this first one, is a news report that came out just maybe a week after they announced these bones. So watch this.
That dinosaur discovery. The scientific world is still reeling from the discovery of actual Tyrannosaurus rex cells and soft tissue unearthed last week at a Montana excavation site. It's a tremendous find that scientists say could unlock the mysteries of extinction and could one day lead to real-life dinosaur cloning. Well, maybe.
Well, North Carolina State University professor Mary Schweitzer is the leader of the discovery team that found these extraordinary specimens. She joins us now from Raleigh with more. Nice to see you, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, how significant a discovery is this?
Well, it has the potential to be very significant, but for right now, until we do further analyses, I think all we can say is it's really cool.
Well, Professor, as I understand it, this was sort of an accidental discovery. You had to split one of the bones in half because it was simply too big to get into a helicopter, and in splitting the bone, you suddenly realized you had this soft tissue on your hands. Is that correct?
Well, it wasn't quite that sudden. They had to split the bone in the field, as was reported, and when it got back to the lab and Carrie Ansell began preparing it, she reserved some of the fragments for chemical analyses, and so it was treated slightly different than most dinosaur bone is in the field.
Is that amazing to find this kind of soft tissue in a fossil this old, and what can the soft tissue really tell us?
Well, it's very amazing. It's utterly shocking, actually, because it flies in the face of everything that we understand about how tissues and cells degrade. It's not something that any one of us could ever predict or hope for. And I think that it's important to remember that we don't know for sure what it still is. It looks like blood vessels, and it looks like bone matrix, and it certainly looks like cells. And
this is about 12 years ago. They found out since then that it really is blood vessels and it really is blood cells that are in there. But this was a week after they announced it, so they're still being tentative about it.
Now help me out because I'm fuzzy on this one. Something that is fossilized by definition should no longer have any blood or remaining tissue. It's down to just rock, right? Now, the way that carbon dating works, unless I'm mistaken, has to do with measuring the half-life of decomposed carbon. So a fossil can't be carbon dated, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, because it doesn't have carbon in it. Okay.
It's like cells, but we haven't done the chemical analysis that let us say what it is for sure.
Professor, a word comes to us that the capillary structure or something that you've observed is actually very similar to that of an ostrich, and I'm wondering, is this add fuel to the idea that the dinosaurs and birds were in fact related?
Well, potentially yes. Realize that the blood vessels in your bone look just exactly the same as well. Vessels at the level that we reported in the paper all kind of look the same. It's the molecular constituents that differ from one animal to another, or from animals to humans. So the potential is there to really tell some differences, but for right now, that's not something that we can address.
How big a T-Rex are we talking about here, Professor?
This one was quite a small T-Rex relative to, say, Sue that's on display in Chicago. It was significantly smaller, but it was also significantly older. And if I'm remembering what Jack told me correctly, it is the first appearance of Tyrannosaurus rex. Therefore, it's the geologically, it's the oldest T-Rex on record.
Would it have wanted to eat us, Mary? Was it a carnivore?
You know, probably. That would be my guess.
Now, is it possible to clone from this kind of tissue? Are we looking at, Ron and I were sort of making fun here of a real-life giraffe.
There is one more I want to show you, but this woman, Mary Schweitzer, her boss is named Jack Horner. Now, you know little Jack Horner that sat in a corner? But Jack Horner is a very famous dinosaur archaeologist. So let me show you one more thing here, because I think you'll really find this interesting. This is out of 60 Minutes, the CBS program that's on CBS.
What happened next happened by mistake. Mary put some fragments of the bone in acid to dissolve away the outermost layer of mineral. But the acid worked too fast, and all the mineral dissolved away. Being a fossil, there should have been nothing left. But there was, and it was elastic, like living tissue.
This is the piece.
No.
She showed us video she took under the microscope.
That's really what happened?
Yes.
That's the dinosaur bone?
Without mineral now. That's what was left.
It looked like the soft tissue she would have expected to find if it had been modern bone. This was impossible. This bone was 68 million years old.
So you see this, and you think, what?
I didn't want to tell anybody.
That you'd be ridiculed,
yes.
Right?
And so I said to my technician, okay, do it again. I don't believe it.
And yet, in sample after sample, they were there. Things that look suspiciously like flexible, transparent blood vessels. She finally mustered the courage to tell Jack.
She said she dissolved the bone away and there were blood vessels. And, you know, I was like shocked. I mean,
how could that be?
How could that be? That's right.
The things Mary was finding inside dinosaur bones.
Look at that.
Blood vessels and even what seemed to be intact cells pose a radical challenge to the existing rules of science. That organic material can't possibly survive even a million years, let alone 68 million. Mary, Jack, and their team published their B-Rex findings in a series of papers in the journal Science and were promptly attacked. Critics said their samples might have been contaminated, or that the supposed blood vessels were actually something called biofilm.
Yeah, I'll stop it there. But you're getting the idea. The important thing is to realize that the idea that maybe it really isn't 60 million years doesn't even cross their minds. It isn't even a possibility. It's 60 million years old. How in the world do blood vessels and blood cells last for 60 million years? That's the way it is until this day. Let me tell you another story that kind of gives you an idea on this. There was a medical student, and he was doing his rounds. He was a resident, and he was going to the psych ward. And there was a guy in there who thought he was dead. Okay, he really thought he was dead. And so this medical student thought, well, I can clear this up for him. I'll prove to him that he's not dead. So when he's talking to the guy, he says, okay, now I want you to know, dead men don't bleed, right? And the resident says, nope, dead men don't bleed. Well, then okay, he grabs a little scalpel and he cuts his finger and uses out some blood. Says, look, here's some blood. And the guy says, well, I'll be. Dead men do bleed. And that's the way it is with these stories. Well, I'll be. Vessels can last for 60 million years. There's no idea that possibly, you know, French fries don't last for 2,000 years in a pyramid, and that vessels don't last 60 million years in a rock. You know, that's what we're up against.
Yeah. So if we were summarizing this, we would see that fossils, as they exist, are not capable of being carbon dated, which is a kind of our primary method for dating things. Probably within the last, say, 10,000 years or so.
Yeah,
like
it's
we can
5,
generally
000,
date something
10, 20, 30,000 years.
Okay.
You can get
so yep. We can generally guess. So anything older than that, we can't carbon date. So anything older than that, we are it's far more complicated than this, but we're guessing at how old it is. And so here we've unearthed, if you paid close attention to the video, the oldest extant T-Rex fossil. And what they say about it is, well, there's still stretchy, spongy blood material inside this T-Rex, which I think they said most of that is usually gone within, what, a few...
Well, if you were to take a dead T-Rex and put it outside in the woods, it'd be gone in a week. You know, it doesn't take any time at all. But if you were to cover it over with something, you know, it would last for a long time, maybe 6,000 years, maybe 4,000 years. You know, it wouldn't last millions and millions of years.
Right. So then the suggestion then becomes, well, clearly we must misunderstand how decaying works rather than we're dating the dinosaurs wrong.
Right.
Why don't we got a couple of minutes that we can take questions on the subject, but then we're going to have to move to our last one kind of quickly, as we're short on time.
Okay.
So any questions specifically about dinosaurs, because I know you want to ask them. No, Jurassic Park is not a real thing. No one has tried to clone dinosaurs. Absolutely real.
If carbon or something like that has have a half-life, then how would it ever fully decay?
How would it ever fully decay? It doesn't, actually. If I were to say that wall there is the end, and I go take a half step every 1 minute or 1 second, I go 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds, 6 seconds. I never reach the wall. I could go there for years, and I'd never reach the wall. Well, yes, that's true. However, when you do that for a billion seconds, you get to the point where there's a slight chance that one atom could still exist. That's what it basically is. Yeah.
They said that the fossil they found was the oldest one in history. Yet you also stated that due to fossils not being able to carbon date, we're basically guessing. So why do so many agree that this is the oldest fossil if there's no way to really tell?
They claim to do the timing by the rock layers. Okay. Now that's a whole nother subject, and something that we as creationists have the strong hand, I believe. But we would be fighting if you're going to university and you were to bring what I'm going to tell you up, they would laugh at you. But that's only because they don't allow supernatural explanations. Okay, because these stratifications, if you go anywhere, look like in the Grand Canyon, or if you go to the Little Grand Canyon here in Pennsylvania, or someplace like that, you'll see that the rock is stratified. But those stratifications are not millions of years. Otherwise, if they were, that dinosaur would have been sitting there open for a long time. It has to get covered immediately, within hours, if it's gonna fossilize. So how can you have it covered up, you know, the whole dinosaur covered up with these stratifications? What happens, according to, you know, our idea, which is a catastrophic idea, is the flood. For all these animals, the flood came and just washed and covered them, you know, hundreds of feet thick with dirt and fossilized and preserved them right away. Sorry? Oh, well, we'll leave that for a separate one. What you got?
As far as I'm concerned, the young Earth idea is closely related to the catastrophic view of history.
Yep.
But the way I view it is you can't truly understand an argument until you've heard both sides of it. So you also have to look at the uniformitarianism.
Absolutely.
Perspective of it. So there are some things, most of them point to the catastrophic view of history, but there are some things that we can't say for sure. Like the White Cliffs of Dover,
mm-hmm.
that goes against catastrophism.
I'm not sure it does, but that's, we're not going to be able to debate it right here. But I wouldn't think that it does. I think the Cliffs of Dover are stratified as well. I think I'm not sure about that though.
And then there are things that are for us are fossil graveyards,
Dinosaur National Park.
Dinosaur National Park, as you mentioned, layered rocks, the unconformities in the mm-hmm. Grand Canyon.
Yep. And the fact that stratifications sometimes go like this.
Yes.
And that requires them to be soft in order to do that. Rock doesn't bend like that.
Right.
And so those bends would have had to happen when the rock was still not rock, and then it turned into rock after it was bent.
Yeah.
So.
And then there are there's different ways to be fossilized. There is. Like your regular fossil, there is carbonization, And then there's one other that I can't remember right now, but
mineralization probably. I think so.
But something that in my science book it said old Earth theorists have they're baffled by this, how there are actually imprints. I believe it's with carbonization when a plant or animal was pressed against something extremely hard, that their imprint is actually on an object, and there are,
like, you can see leaves like that.
You can see leaves, like if you press a leaf to a rock. Yeah. But yeah. There are rocks with imprints of fish eating other fish.
Yeah. One thing I want to mention about this is that the young Earth, you get right out of the Bible, okay? Old Earth, there's old Earth non-believers, you know, but there's also old Earth believers. But you only want to try to, what you're basically trying to do is to fit the Bible to evolution when you're doing an old Earth thing. And I'm really uncomfortable with that. I've been a Christian now for about 40 years. I spent the first few years being a theistic evolutionist, which means that I believe that God used evolution to create things. But I see that that's just totally wrong. The Bible is correct. I believe I'm a six-day creationist. I'm that most radical fundamentalist type. And I think that I've got strong ground, and I'd debate anybody on it. So,
well, we want to keep rolling, so let's get to our next questions.
Do you think that when evolutionists think how the Big Bang Theory, how it exploded and there was, like, light, do you think that they believe when God created, he said, let there be light, as in some evolutionists think that when it exploded, they went, like...
Well, you know, one thing I want to say is, and God said, let there be light, and bang, there was light, you know. So I think there was a big bang, okay? But whether or not, and also, sometime, if you want, I could come back and talk about it, but the universe could actually be both 13 billion years old and 6,000 years old at the same time. That's a whole other subject, but time is strange. Time is not constant. You can have time going fast or slow. And so you can actually have 6 billion years go by in 30 seconds. It's a strange thing. But that's another subject, another day.
Yeah, you're up.
All right. Why didn't God tell Noah to make a big boat and bring all the animals on? If he said all the animals, why weren't the dinosaurs on it?
Well, the dinosaurs were on it. One dinosaur, you know, a pair of dinosaurs, rather. But, you know, dinosaurs were on the ark, but most of the dinosaurs died, just like most of the everything else died. But two dinosaurs of each kind, were on the ark. And if you've been to the ark that's in Kentucky, we were there. It's big. It is a big boat. And one of the big questions is, why does it have to be so big? Because, for instance, you know how many dogs there would have to be on the ark? Two. All the dogs that you know, from the Great Dane to the Chihuahua, all the Shar Pei and all the different weird dogs, they all come from the same stock. They're all dogs. And you can take a German Shepherd and mate it with a poodle and get a German Shepoodle, right? You know, you can get whatever you want.
I'm pretty sure that's a thing.
What's that?
I'm pretty sure that's a thing.
Yeah.
And if people think that evolution's real and we were around for 1 million years, don't you think we would have already been something else?
Well, that's a debatable thing. It's hard to say. But I don't think that we can change that much. You know, we are what we are. We're humans, and we can't change. We were created separately from the animals. We're not even animals, according to the Bible. We are a separate creation. Okay? Do we have enough time? Because I want to make sure we have the third
time. No, we got to wrap up for time.
Okay, let me keep going then, okay?
No, I mean, like, we have to, like, wrap up for time. We're out of time. This is really great. Let's give Jim a big round of applause for being with us. What we'll do, we didn't get to Jim's third point, so Jim and I will find a day, probably in the next couple of weeks, and we'll get together and kind of do a dialogue about it, and we'll try to record it and get it online so you guys can listen to it. We'll throw it on Facebook or something like that, so that we can kind of get to that final point, because I think it's really important. Great. So if I can, let me pray for us, and then I just want to thank you all for coming. And on your way out the door, please make sure that you get one of these lovely flyers about Operation Christmas Child.